This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Finding out a loved one has lung cancer is the beginning of a story that almost never ends well. But once that story's over, the people left behind often start a new one that tries to capture the spirit of the person they lost.
She was a reporter doing a story on lung cancer, and he never even knew that he was talking to her on her deathbed.
On today's Health Show, we'll hear from a father who lost a daughter and celebrated her life and writings in a book. We'll also listen in on a discussion about the disease with a doctor, a survivor, and a sister who was left behind. Dr. Nina Sachs is away this week. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Lauren Terrazano wore a lot of hats in her life. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, social activist, and weekly columnist at Newsday on Long Island. Unfortunately, that weekly column was called Life with Cancer, and it began shortly after Lauren was diagnosed with lung cancer. She wrote that column until her death 3 years later. Now her father has taken her writings as well as interviews with her doctors and colleagues and put them together in the book Life with Cancer. Along with his co-author, Paul Leonardo, Frank Terrazano has crafted a book that chronicles Lauren's passion and devotion to her career and the causes she championed, as well as his obvious love for his daughter. I spoke with Frank Terrazano recently about the book and his daughter, Lauren.
When she first got into journalism, after she graduated Boston University here, and she went off to New York and then went to Columbia to get her master's, but she always used to say to me, Daddy, someday I'm going to get a Pulitzer Prize, and I hope to write a book. Well, the first part of that she accomplished in part, sharing a Pulitzer with her Newsday colleagues for the coverage of the 1996 TWA Flight 800 disaster off Long Island. And with regard to the book, she never got the opportunity to write that book of hers, and that was what I had hoped to, in some small way, fulfill that wish for her.
Well, this book comes out of a column that she wrote while she was with Newsday. Tell us about the column. Well,
sure.
First, tell us about the day that you found out that Lauren had lung cancer.
That was back in, I'll never forget, she was diagnosed in August, but she never told us. We didn't find out until September 4th. It was about a month later because she was reluctant to tell us, always concerned about how it was going to affect us. My daughter was a truly altruistic young lady. I say that not because I'm her dad, but in everything she did, all aspects of her life when she was very young, always caring and always, whether it be animals, or injured animals or whatever the case may be, but and people, I'm always putting them first, you know, and that was just her makeup. It was a wonderful trait of hers, it really was, and she carried that into her work. Writing, when she wrote for Newsday, she courageously wrote about her disease the last 7 or 8 months of her life with that weekly column, Life with Cancer. And even then, she titled that column Life, comma, with Cancer, because she used to say to me, Dad, my cancer is secondary, okay? I'm still going to live my life as best as I can. And she really did that. She really strived to do that, you know, even up to the time she passed on us, you know.
Did she talk to you about the thought process, what she thought about when she said, you know, okay, I'm going to write this and let people know what I'm going through?
She did talk to us about it, and I encouraged her to do so. I mean, she was always very forthright with everything, with her friends. All her friends often said they knew exactly where they stood with her. You know, she was not afraid to tell them exactly what she thought, and that's the trait that I admired her. I tend to be somewhat of a loudmouth myself, you know, the same way. I mean, I call things as I see them, and one of the traits I hope she inherited from me. So, but the prime reason for the book was, okay, she was very, very courageous with regard to the fight against cancer and how she documented and all the research she did with regard to lung cancer. But for 14 years, my daughter worked as a journalist, okay, a true journalist who really took up the cause for abused children, the elderly, homeless, the mentally retarded, and she became a voice for the voiceless in our society. And that's the thing I wanted also to bring forth.
Talk about the structure of the book. You do include her writing as part of the book. In fact, that kind of introduces each new section of the book.
Yes, we used excerpts from her columns that she wrote, primarily just kind of intermingle those with the various interviews we did with the colleagues and friends and what have you, and also some of the stories that she wrote, what I refer to as the societal type of writings, you know, with regard to columns or undercover investigations that she did with regard to nursing homes in Long Island, night court. There were so many stories that she wrote, you know, in the 14 years she was there, all with regard to benefiting those individuals who didn't have a voice, you know, that she became their voice. She championed a lot of the causes. My wife and I were fortunate enough to receive a couple of awards posthumously after she passed, and we met more people One of them happened to be a Suffolk Community Council on Long Island. They named her the 2008 Advocate of the Year. And we went to the dinner, and while there, we came across, so many people came up to us and introduced themselves to us. They ran homes for abused children or the homeless, and all of them, to a letter, basically said Lauren helped them so much with her writing as far as getting funds or funding or things of that nature. And also, she said she always wrote with dignity about the individuals that she was writing about.
There seems to be an attitude about lung cancer that you did it to yourself.
Yes.
Did she come across that, and how did she react towards that?
Absolutely. You know, that's the thing she was trying to correct, was the stigma associated with lung cancer. Lauren, I smoked for 30 years, Bob, but I gave them up maybe 20 years ago, you know. But Lauren smoked a bit in college, and she smoked from time to time, just lightly. And as a matter of fact, her doctors considered her a non-smoker. In the columns that she wrote, the actual full columns that she wrote, there was so much information. She did more investigating and more research with regard to it as she was fighting this disease. Matter of fact, I'll give you an instance where almost the very end of her life, about, I think it was, I can't remember exactly, maybe a couple of weeks before she passed away, she did one of the final interviews. She contacted from her hospital bed a marketing director of the manufacturer of Camel cigarettes, and she proceeded to ask him, you know, all about the disease and what they were doing, because they were, at the time, they had this marketing campaign. They were promoting cigarettes to women, you know, and she never let him know she was in her hospital bed 2 weeks away from dying. All right, just took the approach that she was a reporter doing a story on lung cancer, and he never even knew that he was talking to her on her deathbed.
And she was in a bit of pain at that time, too,
yes,
wasn't she?
Yes, she was. She was heavily medicated with morphine and what have you, and she was just one hell of a kid. You know, Bob, one other thing I wanted to mention to you, I'll give you another instance where I said she was always thinking of others. Lauren, when she went to Columbia, she also taught there part-time as an adjunct professor. She met a young lady from Guatemala by the name of Dina Fernandez, and they became very close friends, and Dina used to come up to visit us, and likewise, Lauren would go down to Guatemala to visit Dina. Well, back in October of 2005, Lauren was in kind of a semi-remission, I guess. She had had her surgery. They removed her lung in December of 2004. She underwent chemo and radiation, and October of that year, Dina had asked her, why don't you go down and get away, you know, for a while from her treatments and so forth. And as I say, we thought she was in remission, let's put it that way. Well, anyway, she made the trip down, and while there, Hurricane Stan had hit the area. And Guatemala, the mountain villages got inundated with the heavy rains and what have you, and caused all sorts of mudslides, and entire villages were completely swallowed up with the mudslides. Well, Lauren, how she pulled it off, I still don't know to this day, but she was able to get a hold of the U.S. Army Southern Command, who were down there. They were trying to help the people of Guatemala, delivering foodstuffs and what have you. Well, she somehow convinced them to allow her to ride aboard a Chinook helicopter with four young, very brave pilots. And she spent 15 hours going up and down, visiting all those villages, bringing them water and foodstuffs and so forth, because she really genuinely, as I said before, you know, loved to help people, you know, any way she possibly could. So we didn't find out about it, again, because she was always covering up, always afraid to worry us. And we didn't find out about it until after she got back to the States here, and her friends at the newspaper, right, told us about it. So she was just one heck of a kid, you know.
You got another Pulitzer Prize winner to write the foreword to the book, Anna Quinlan. How'd that come across?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, Anna Quinlan is remarkable. What a remarkable lady. Lauren, many years ago, had received the CWLA Award. It was the Child Welfare League, the Anna Quinlan Child Welfare League of America Award. So just by chance, I didn't know how to get in touch with her, and I thought about that. So I did a Google search, and I found out she was married to an attorney in New Jersey. And I put together a package and sent it off to the attorney with the hope to give it to her. And about 4 or 5 days later, I got an email from Anna Quinlan. And she said in her email, she said, there was no need for you to package all of that stuff about Lauren and what have you. She said, I was fully aware of what your daughter did, you know, the type of writing she did and so forth and so on. And she was so gracious enough. So I asked her if she would be kind enough to write a foreword, and she agreed wholeheartedly. And she put together one hell of a foreword to it. Really a great, great piece of writing for her.
And how did you get hooked up with Paul?
I found, I started writing this December of 2010 and not having any training whatsoever. I'm just a high school grad. I think I made it through English class okay in high school, but I started writing this, and it was a mishmash on my word processor, you know, here, there, and everywhere. I had about 40 or 50 pages and completely no structure whatsoever. Well, I happened to see Paul on a Boston television station one evening. He had co-written a book with a woman. He was on there promoting the book, and he had his website, he had his email address. So I dropped him a line. I told him what I was doing and that I needed probably some help So, Paul, we worked out an arrangement, and here we are.
You never get over something like this, but has this helped maybe put an exclamation point on what she went through?
Yeah, to some degree. You know, the irony is that it's a double-edged sword, good and bad. It rehashes everything that you went through in that period while she was undergoing her fight with cancer. Because every time you sent a manuscript out, their editors would send it back, and it had to be revised, and it would start, you know, reading everything all over again. So, as I say, it had good points and bad points. I mean, the good points are that we're hopeful that the book will help give better insight onto the disease itself of lung cancer. And the other thing I would like to mention, Bob, when shortly after Lauren passed away, we established a scholarship at Columbia in her name. And the scholarship over the years now has grown. When my wife and I, we tried to fund it as best we can each year. And along with the help from former colleagues of hers and friends, the scholarship has grown, and Columbia has been able to award smaller scholarships, maybe $1,000, $1,500, but they've done so every year since Lauren passed away. So at least in one respect, long after my wife and I are gone, Lauren's name will remain in perpetuity.
Again, the name of Frank Terrazano in Paul DiNardo's book is Life with Cancer, The Lauren Terrazano Story. It's published by HCI Books. Still to come, we'll listen in on a discussion about lung cancer from three people who have all been affected in some way by the disease. That's next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1288. This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett. Last month, the Lung Cancer Alliance New York, in partnership with Albany Medical Center, had a vigil to shine a light on lung cancer. The purpose of the vigil was to share compassion and hope and raise public awareness. Lung cancer is the leading cause of all cancer death, second only to heart disease as the leading disease killer. Before the vigil was held, The Health Show's Joe Donahue sat down with three people who participated in the event, people who have all been affected by lung cancer in some way. Phyllis Goldstein is a 9-year lung cancer survivor. Betsy McPhail had a sister who was diagnosed at age 24 and died at age 25. And Dr. Marp Napier is the medical director of the multi-specialty lung cancer program at Albany Medical Center Hospital. Dr. Napier starts by talking about a topic we touched on with Frank Terrazano earlier, the stigma surrounding lung cancer.
Well, I think a lot of people blame lung cancer patients for their disease because most of lung cancer patients are smokers, about 85%. And I think it's a terrible stigma. I think the people that hold the blame for lung cancer are really the tobacco companies and the tobacco industry. Also, 15% of our lung cancer patients are never smokers. And certainly they can't be held accountable for this terrible disease. It's a national epidemic, claims about 160,000 lives a year. And the bulk of those are preventable deaths if we didn't have the tobacco problem that we have in this country.
When we use that term never smoker, that's obvious, that people who have never smoked that have contracted the disease.
Right.
And both of our guests, both Betsy's sister as well as Phyllis, never smokers, right?
Correct.
So, Phyllis, what was it like for you to get that diagnosis and think to yourself, well, I never smoked. How would I get that?
You know, it was such a shock. Unbelievable. And it was something that, well, I wasn't angry, but I was like, what is going on? Is there something wrong with the air we breathe? Mm. Because my best friend had fallen off her patio and went to the emergency room. And when they took an x-ray of her arm, which she broke near her shoulder, they saw a spot on her lung. She was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and she was a never smoker, and she lived one block from where I live. And we walked every single morning for 35 years. And 6 months after her diagnosis, I had a cough, a cold actually. And when it went away, I had a cough, and my husband said, go to the doctor, go to the doctor. Look what happened to Susan. I said, you're overreacting. Well, I finally gave in and I went, and I was diagnosed with stage 3A lung cancer. I was shocked. And I was lucky, though, because stage 3A is operable and hers wasn't. Mm. And she died 2 years later. So I am a rare person, I tell people, because I survived, and only 15% of us survive 5 years or more, whereas breast cancer survivors survive past 5 years or more. 89% of them do.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, it's been 9 years since you were diagnosed. Why is that, Doctor, the rarity of that?
Well, most lung cancer is diagnosed at an advanced stage. So about 80% of our lung cancer is diagnosed stage 3 or higher, and most of those patients aren't surgical candidates. Lung cancer begins silently and grows silently, so it's not until it becomes more advanced and causes symptoms that we usually detect it. Though we're starting to make some inroads on that with lung cancer screening, which is the new sort of revolutionary moment in lung cancer care.
So, Phyllis, you were operated on then?
Yes.
And that was, at what point did you think, okay, well, this will be better and I'm hopeful?
Well, I have to tell you that once you have a primary lung cancer, you are at high risk for a second primary lung cancer, and I need to be screened every year by low-dose CT scans to make sure I catch it early if I get another primary.
So even 9 years later, you're still, it's something that's a cloud over you, I assume.
Yes.
Let us welcome Betsy McPhail to the program. She is, her sister was diagnosed at the age of 24 and died a year later.
Yes.
Again, a non-smoker.
Correct. She had a genetic mutation that caused her lung cancer. And unfortunately, it seems to be becoming more and more common, especially for young women. And like Dr. Napier was saying, she didn't have any signs, any symptoms until she reached stage 4. She was operated on, but unfortunately, it already gotten to an advanced stage and it was too late.
At what point, how was it diagnosed? Was it?
She had a cough.
Okay.
She was training for a half marathon and she began to have trouble breathing. So she had a cough. She went to the doctor. They misdiagnosed her over several months. And finally, they biopsied her tumor and found it was cancerous. But even at that point, they didn't think it was lung cancer and they didn't think it had spread. They thought she'd have the operation and it would be done with.
When you look at, and Dr. I guess I'll ask you this question, as far as Betsy goes, given her sister's history, then how important is it for Betsy to be regularly checked?
That's a very good question. This is an evolving area. There is a recognition that lung cancer can have a genetic risk associated with it. So having a first-degree relative, a sibling, a parent, or children with lung cancer increases your risk. We still know the most powerful risk for lung cancer is smoking, and we are only screening high-risk patients right now. So we don't really have screening protocols for people who have family members. But it's taken on a case-by-case basis in conjunction with a genetic counselor trying to make decisions with each person about whether they should be screened. Right now, screening for lung cancer is done with CAT scans.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they're low dose, it's still radiation exposure. So we have to balance the risks of radiation with the benefits of screening. So we're still only recommending screening for high-risk patients who are heavy smokers. But presumably in the future, we'll have more information about the genetics of lung cancer, and we may broaden the groups that we're screening.
What's a genetic counselor?
A genetic counselor is somebody who specializes in the genetic mutations and genetic risks that people carry from their own genetic profile, and they guide people in the workup, management, and screening of various genetic abnormalities.
Mm-hmm.
Because simply having a genetic mutation doesn't mean you'll develop the disease associated with that in all cases. So it's a complicated issue with what genetic risks come with what genetic mutations.
You spoke earlier about the revolutionary aspect of the screening process. What does that now allow you to do?
So there was a trial called the National Lung Screening Trial, which was published. The results were published last year, which looked at screening patients at high risk for lung cancer. And they looked at patients aged 55 to 74 who had smoked more than a pack a day for 30 years. And they screened them with either a low-dose CAT scan of the chest or an annual chest X-ray. And what they found is the patients who got the low-dose CAT scan of the chest had a relative 20% reduction in lung cancer death compared to the chest x-ray. And there was another trial looking at chest x-ray screening versus no screening at all, and it was found that chest x-rays were not beneficial. So what we've learned from these two trials is that people who are at high risk for lung cancer, who get a low-dose CAT scan of the chest on an annual basis in a multidisciplinary setting. So that's a program that includes pulmonologists, advanced thoracic surgeons, medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, pathologists, and radiologists, that we can reduce their risk of dying of lung cancer by 20%. And we have not really made inroads in the mortality rate from lung cancer in the past, and this is finally giving us an opportunity to start making a dent in those terrible statistics that we lose 85% of our lung cancer patients within 5 years.
85%.
That's why we need research for lung cancer. There's so many unknowns about it, and we need to have a vaccination, a blood test, a urine test, a breath test, a sputum test. I mean, something that is easily accessible to all, and that's cheap, and we don't have that. I know people are out there trying to work on it, but the funding for lung cancer research is the least major funded cancer from the federal government. You know, the federal government sponsors breast cancer research, prostate, colon, and very little of it goes to lung cancer.
Again, because I guess the thought process being, well, if people didn't smoke, it wouldn't be an issue. When you look at, for the two of you, in your case of having never smoked and then coming down with in the cancer for you and for your sister, is just as rare as it would
no,
be?
No, it isn't rare. I want to tell you that 25,000 women this year, never smokers, will be diagnosed with lung cancer. And it's the fastest growing cancer diagnosis.
So it's growing?
Yes. In never smoking women.
Well, and what I was going to say is that because you also hear the opposite, which also seems to be the abnormality, where someone has smoked for their entire life, a pack or two a day for 30, 40 years, and you know, die of a heart attack at 97. So, but that's an abnormality too, I would assume.
Mm-hmm. Some people can get away with smoking with regards to emphysema or heart disease or lung cancer, but there are most people can't. Most people are going to get some tobacco-related disease who are heavy smokers. And I think anytime we talk about lung cancer, we have to talk about the importance of people stopping smoking and anti-tobacco efforts, because a lot of the disease associated with tobacco is preventable if people didn't smoke. But because cigarettes are so addictive, that you really have to focus not on the individual solely, but also on the tobacco industry as a whole and the tobacco epidemic that we have as a whole.
And also, I'd like to point out, you can't tell people who already quit smoking to quit. And 80% of newly diagnosed cases are in former smokers and never smokers.
Phyllis Goldstein is a 9-year lung cancer survivor. Betsy McPhail had a sister who was diagnosed at age 24, and Dr. Mark Napier is the medical director of the multi-specialty lung cancer program at Albany Medical Center Hospital. They spoke with the Health Show's Joe Donahue. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.